Thank you very much, Shane. Tonight on Arena, Shooting the Darkness, photographs from the Northern Irish Troubles. And we profile Australian comedian Hannah Gatsby ahead of her appearance in Dublin this weekend. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Based on the acclaimed documentary Shooting the Darkness, which was shown on RTE earlier this year, a new book presents the stories of seven photographers whose images captured the most important events of the Northern Irish Trouble. They talk about the photographs they took, how they got the shot, what it cost them to take the photograph, and reflect on whether it was worth it. With me in studio, two of those photographers, Alan Lewis and Crispin Rodwell, and the producer of the documentary, Thomas Kelly, who I presume was also very instrumental in the publication of the book, which is also called Shooting the Darkness. It was the reaction in some ways to the documentary, I think, Thomas, that sent you off, and sent the book into publication.
Sean. After the documentary aired, Blackstaff Press in Belfast got in touch with us, and we'd been thinking that perhaps it would make a good book. But they got in touch with us. They had done other work around the Troubles, such as reporting the Troubles. Ivan Little and Derek Henderson's book kind of touched on a lot of the same themes. And so, that kind of got the conversation going. Then we spoke to all of the photographers who had been involved in the documentary to see if they were interested in kind of carrying the project forward, and they were. So
And I think one of the great things about the book is because these are photographs, they are still images. I mean, no matter how often you see them on the screen, and when we saw them in the documentary, the documentary was a great piece of television, but you don't have the time to look at the photographs that perhaps you have when you have the book in front of you, when you can actually open it, look at it, read about it, look at it again, and actually really take in the image in front of you. The book allows you to do that.
Oh, absolutely. And indeed, that's one of the things like Hugh Russell mentions in the documentary, that how when you have the image in front of you in print, it's more impactful. You can't look away. You can't scroll up from it. You can't change the channel. It really does kind of sear itself into your memory.
Yeah, and also the director of the documentary doesn't need to say, "Well, I've got 54 minutes of television. I better get a move on. I can't delay on this particular still." But let's talk to both Alan and Lewis about that moment. Maybe Alan, first of all, when you capture something, because I don't know who it is that mentions in the documentary, but this idea, I think it's Tom Lawlor actually of the Irish Times, talks about this idea that there's mayhem quite often happening all around you, and yet you're looking for the split second that will actually capture that, you know, could be 3 hours of mayhem, a split second that actually defines it and tells the whole story.
Yeah, I think Tom actually referred to it as distilling the moment. It's something that you practice, you train, and you're actually taking the photograph, becomes second nature. It's automatic, and you're actually looking like a director probably at a scene as it emerges in front of you, and you're trying to pick key moments out.
But are you all the time there with your camera up at your eye, rather than, there's no point in you having the camera down, I suppose, and looking around at what's happening.
You're looking through the lens most of the time, through at what's happening in front of you, or your camera's close up to your face and you're looking over the top of it.
Because if you're
covering, for example, a riot, the focal point of a riot can change in a flash, really. You know, you could be at the point of a triangle photographing army or police at one side and rioters at the other, and the next thing, police move and you're behind them and the rocks and bricks are coming over on top of you.
I guess, though, Crispin, part of the camera then, what it presents you with, it kind of separates you from what you're looking at, because in some cases what you're looking at is, you know, they are terrible events unfolding in front of you, dangerous events, in fact. Does the camera kind of, is it like, you know, when you're driving along in your car and there's all sorts of things maybe happening around you on the road, but you're in this little bubble of where you think you're almost untouchable. Does the camera give you a kind of an armour, perhaps, in that situation?
I never felt particularly strengthened
Or safe
because I had a camera. Certainly, seldom did we feel very, very threatened. It did happen at times, but the I think the press got off fairly lightly in terms of casualties. Mm. But I think there was an acceptance on all sides that we were there doing a job, that we weren't combatants, that we weren't there to make anything happen.
Yeah, you were simply recording what was happening in front of your eyes. I mean, I want to talk about specifically some of the photographs that are in the book, and the first one that I want to talk about is one that I've simply called Baby on page 48 of the book. This was a very important day, I think, for you, Alan.
Yes. You
might remind us what exactly had happened on this particular day. I'll just get the exact date now. You probably remember the date, in fact, do you?
It's December 71.
Yeah. December the 11th. Yeah.
Yeah. There'd been an explosion at a furnishing company on the Shankill Road. There'd been two babies killed along with two adults and a lot of people injured. But I'd arrived up well after the actual explosion. I'd been off duty that day, but sort of presented myself and went up. And they were still digging through in the rubble. And I'd only just started out of university, and I hadn't seen anything, anything that would have shocked me before.
Mm. So you were quite young then at this time?
Yeah, I would have been 19 then.
Yeah.
A question of placing yourself beside an ambulance, staying out of the road of the first responders who were doing the job of trying to get people injured away. And they brought a baby out of the rubble, and I just had the finger on the shutter release and couldn't actually take a picture of what I was looking at. It was just horrific.
This particular baby was dead. Was it clear to you that the baby was dead?
It was just, it was like something out of a horror film.
Yeah.
The baby wasn't covered, and the ambulance man just brought the baby towards me, past me and into the ambulance.
But something stopped you from taking that particular shot?
I just couldn't tell. It was just, I froze. I just was so horrified at what was coming at me in my lens.
Later on, though, then, a second first responder comes out.
It was actually the same ambulance man. It was about maybe 20 or so minutes later. This time he was carrying another baby, and it was wrapped up in a blanket. And period of time, I'd sort of resolved to myself, if I was going to make a career here, I would have to sort of start taking pictures and forget, you know, what I was saying, and just actually take the picture and then, you know, deal with it afterwards.
Yeah, and it's one of the things that really strikes me about the image is the fact that, yes, it's horrific. Obviously, the baby, again, we can presume that this baby, unfortunately, was killed in the event as well. But it's the care with which the ambulance man holds the baby. There's some comfort in that. And did the parents get to see this? Do you know?
I honestly don't know. I mean, they would have seen the photograph, certainly, because it's in the years afterwards, it was turned into a mural.
Yeah. In fact, you thought that this photograph, when people see a baby carried out of a situation like this, they'll say, this has to end. It had quite the opposite effect.
It had. I sort of told myself that maybe if somebody sees this, it'll turn them away from violence, possibly, because that's the way I would have thought. But apparently I was talking to David Irvine from the Progressive Unionist Party, aligned to the UVF, and he said it had the opposite effect. But he did sort of... He did say to me that that picture actually did bring people like him into the peace process.
Yeah.
So maybe 30 years later,
it
would have had a positive effect, but it didn't have the effect at the time.
Took time.
No.
I might be making presumptions here, but when Alan talks about being 19 back at that point, I think you might have come into photography a little bit later on, Crispin. Am I right in thinking that?
You are. When Alan took that picture, it was the day after my 10th birthday.
Right.
And then 22 years later, also on the Shankill Road, only 300 or 400 metres from where Alan had done the pictures, in very, very similar circumstances. Saturday afternoon, very, very busy, lots of shoppers around. 9 people in a fishmonger's in Frizzell's fish shop were killed. 3 of them were children. They were killed when a bomb was carried in and placed on the counter. It exploded prematurely and killed the IRA man who was delivering the bomb. The
I'm looking at two particular photographs from that, a number that you took on that day, of the funeral cortege. Three hearses in this particular case stopped directly outside the place where the bomb had spoken. There's another point in the documentary and in the book where people talk about the silence when something happens. In fact, I think it was about Bloody Sunday, this moment of silence around the body of Jack Duddy is spoken about. Was there a side that this to me looks like a very silent moment? Is there a kind of an atmosphere around these photographs that perhaps gives you the moment to hit the you know, to open the shutter?
There's great reverence in the picture. You can see a couple of hundred people lining both sides of the Shankill Road, and as you say, three hearses side by side stopped right beside where it had happened. In the hearses were Evelyn Baird, her partner Michael Morrison, and their 7-year-old daughter Michelle.
Very important for you, I think, because it's here in the book, it's there in the documentary, and now you've done it again tonight. Saying those names, I think, is that important for you?
It is, and I think in our small way, I hope that working on the documentary and the book has it's a memorial to the people whose deaths and bereavement we've recorded in the book. It is important.
There's another moment where we hear about what's called a collect. Maybe explain to us what a collect is, first of all, Alan.
When someone has been killed or seriously injured in an explosion or a shooting, we would have, all the photographers would have had to go to the house of the bereaved family and ask if we could borrow a photograph of the deceased. And it was the single most difficult part of the job because, you know, you were actually intruding on people's personal grief. You knew you were doing it. You didn't like doing it, but... Yeah. It was a necessary evil as far as we were concerned.
And you had an awful collect situation where you were sent to the house of a young woman you knew.
Yeah, there was a girl called Irene Andrews who was with a nationalist senator, Paddy Wilson, who was a big friend of Jerry Fitz, one of the founders of the SDLP. And Paddy and Irene were both murdered by loyalist paramilitaries, and the names eventually emerged on the morning after the bodies were discovered. I went to the house of the mother of Irene, knowing that Irene was a personal friend of mine, and thought it maybe be easier if I was able to sort of put a personal face to asking for the collect. But when I got to the door, she just said, "Oh, Irene's not here yet. Alan, come on in, have a cup of tea."
She didn't know
anything. She didn't know. And I just felt like I wanted the ground to open up underneath me. And I had tried to make desperate excuses to get out of the house. And she was asking me, was it about her Irish dancing? And I just wanted out of there. And eventually I did manage to talk my way out of the house. And I said I would get in touch with her again. But then I rang the police and told them that the woman didn't know
to get a
minister or a priest or somebody up to actually be with her and let her know what has happened. That was several hours after the media became aware of the name.
Incredibly difficult stuff. Yeah. I mean, a lot of the material that is in the book is totally on stage, but I think several people point out at different points that the Republicans, the Republican side of the conflict here were much better at being sure that the images were caught. I think the very first photograph you took, your first photograph as a freelancer, in fact, Crispin, it has to have been staged. You didn't catch this by accident. And this is the one, what I'm calling the tongue delivery.
The picture shows three pill-sized pellets on the tongue of a prisoner's mother. And what the pellets are communications coming out of the Mays prison right at the start of the 1981 hunger strike. And my father was a journalist, and he received in the post one sheet of prison-issued toilet paper with microscopic writing over one side of it. This was then rolled into a tiny little pellet wrapped in cling film, and the prisoners and their visitors would exchange them when they kissed each other goodbye. So my father, being the inquisitive type, contacted the number that was on the sheet of paper, which was this prisoner's mother, and we went along to talk to her, and she was happy posing with three as yet undelivered letters on her tongue.
Yeah, and then we see on the other side of the page one, well, maybe not one of those three, but a letter actually opened out. That's, and the writing is tiny.
Yeah.
It has to be said. What are you hoping this book will achieve, just as we round up?
Well, I think there are a lot of the stories, like you mentioned before, you only have an hour of television to tell certain stories. Mm. And all of the photographers, like over the periods that we spoke to them, had so much to talk about, so many incredible pictures, and this, I suppose, gives kind of breathing space to them. It lets kind of expands on the documentary.
I asked you before we came to air, Crispin, about the little boy jumping in front of the Time for Peace on the wall, and that wasn't staged. It's such a spontaneous shot, but I want to finish by going to Alan, if you don't mind, and the shot you have of Louis Johnson at the funeral of his father in 1997, little boy, 7-year-old, like grief stricken, and it's just, he's caught in between the arms of two of the pallbearers, and you see how painful it is from watching his father be buried. There's a beautiful end to this.
Well, when I took that picture, the little boy was just so grief stricken. It sort of had a lasting impact on me, and for years, I always wondered what had happened to him. And he was invited along to the book launch in Belfast, and I got to meet him and talk to him about his dad and talk to him about the picture, and it was just closure for me, really.
What did the picture mean for him?
He actually didn't want to discuss what the picture meant for him, but he was happy to be there and sort of lend his support to the book. It's always very, very difficult when you're dealing with people who have sort of been bereaved.
Don't want to be prurient about it.
No, but the nice ending to it for me was that he'd got his university degree, he'd got a good job, and his wife was with him, and she was 4 months from giving birth. Ah. So it was a happy ending for me. You know, okay. I was just delighted to see that.
And when was that launch?
It was about 3 weeks ago in Belfast.
Right, so she's 3 and a bit months now.
Yeah,
so
3 and a bit months.
Best of luck to the both of them, and hopefully that will all go well for them. Thomas Kelly, producer there, Crispin Rodwell and Alan Lewis, photographers, speaking to me about the book Shooting the Darkness, published by Blackstaff Press. And by the way, you can watch the documentary of the same name. It's still available on the RTE player. As an area of academic study, many educational observers feel that the humanities have been somewhat under attack in recent years, broadly encompassing areas such as languages, literature, history, politics and the arts. They tend to be set apart from the so-called STEM subjects, science, technology, engineering and maths. Last week, the Irish Humanities Alliance launched a new initiative entitled By Imagination We Live, arguing that we should revisit our attitudes to the humanities and that they should be equally central to our social, cultural and technological future. The initiative was launched by writer and humanities champion Marina Warner, author of such groundbreaking texts as Alone of All Her Sex, The Cult of the Virgin Mary, and Monuments and Maidens, The Allegory of the Female Form. While she was in Ireland, Marina Warner came into Arena here, into studio for a chat. I started by asking her whether the humanities were really under threat, and if so, from where, from what, and from whom?
Well, I think that the humanities is rather a heavy word for something that is very much part of our organic social fabric and also our personal lives, the interior of our heads. So the first thing that probably the humanities were the classics, were Latin and Greek. But then they've been broadened out to take in everything from architecture to music. So really it's the whole cultural perspective and the way you and I relate with shared memories of having read this or that or heard a piece of music or a pop song. So it's a very large category. But what happened is that many governments, including definitely the UK's, decided that these were luxuries. This was just simply sort of idle pleasures, probably for a very reprobate elite. And instead of it actually being the imaginative texture of everybody's life, everybody should be working on the sciences, the hard sciences. So it was, they were distinguished from what we call STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Although mathematics used to be considered a humanities subject, oddly enough. So, and this means that in the schools, there's been a fall in take-up of subjects such as art and languages. Sometimes this fall is driven by the lack of funding, lack of funding for music in schools, absolutely lack of funding for dance, for example, which is very good for children, to give them, you know, poise and relate to each other and feel themselves beings in the world of freedom. So these things have all been denigrated and relegated. And there's been, as you know, a great rise in SAT tests and very, very, very positivist ways of measuring outcomes, testing children, things that are not the holistic person. But I would say that what this document by Imagination We Live is emphasizing is how very important it is to understand how we shape our values and how those values are shaped by all the different means of expression that exist in the world, going from the most recondite poem, which is hard to understand, but nevertheless valuable, to mass media tweets. I mean, these form, as I said before, the sort of texture of our world. And we need to understand them and to see how they are contributing to the common ground, shaping the body politic and the individual person.
Maybe this, I think this possibly links into something that has interested you for your entire thinking life, I would guess, which is the role of story, the role of fairy tale, the role of myth. Now, I know I'm putting three terms that you could write a book on each one separately, but you know, let's just take the three terms, you know, together there. How has the role of, let's say, story, for simplicity's sake, how has that role changed now in the 21st century with the presence of, as you say, you know, the tweet, the short message? We were always told brevity was the soul of wit. Is it perhaps the tweet is a way of learning, teaching us to be just that, brief?
Yes, absolutely. No, I mean, I have a friend who wrote a series of love songs, which were just a sort of series of tweets. No, it's perfectly possible as a medium to use it for, you know, tender things. Can't happen that often, but... I think that story has actually become to be recognized, partly through the work of artists and writers and scholars, as infinitely profoundly important to memory. So how things are remembered. You know, Seamus Heaney used this wonderful phrase that it should be the grief, not the grievance, that should be in mind and for the past. And those telling those stories of the past, so that the grief is remembered and atoned for, if possible, but not the grievance, not the grudge. And he wrote some marvelous things about this. So this importance, it's not a question of propaganda. It's not a question of revisioning the story so that it suits us in a sort of Stalinist kind of way. But it's actually facing up to issues of the past. And it has happened in my lifetime. I've seen extraordinary new ways of telling the stories of women, of obscured women, including, for example, here, the Magdalene sisters, you know, that sort of tragedy. And then there's now a vigorous re-memorizing, re-excavating the stories of completely silenced people, slaves. But the historians have got to work, the poets have got to work, the writers have got to work, and this history, this submerged history, is being told in ways that do help. First of all, for us to recognize the other, if the other seems unfamiliar, and perhaps, I mean, one hopes, will promote a sort of mutual understanding that is not necessarily forgiveness, but is a kind of recognition, and recognition in itself can be a form of reparation. To be seen and heard actually can help heal divisions.
You have something, Marina, that you want to share with us, which in fact gives us a real sense of the importance of stories, songs or stories as well, essentially, as we'll hear. What is this?
It's the Russian poet Velimir Klebnikov. It goes, "When horses die, they sigh. When grasses die, they shrivel. When suns die, they flare and expire. When people die, they sing songs."
You have written a lot about the whole idea of how the fairy tale has changed and how feminism, in fact, has added to and expanded the way in which the fairy tale is told. I suppose I'm thinking in particular here, you mentioned pictures earlier on. How film has changed that, both positively and negatively, and we can hang it on two Disney films, essentially, the positive and the negative. Mm. Maleficent, you think, is a great adaptation and a great retelling of a fairy tale.
Well, I did enjoy it. I mean, I think Angelina Jolie, who's a producer as well as in it, really, you know, is quite a bona fide feminist. And she's very much put her work where her beliefs are. She hasn't compromised. And that it does have a beautiful twist.
It's the Sleeping Beauty story, essentially.
Yes, it's the Sleeping Beauty story, and it has a beautiful twist because it redeems the normal hostility in these stories between the stepmother, the older woman, and the younger beauty. And so here, and I was taken aback by that, and tears did fall from my eyes.
Yeah, there's no kissing of the princess by a handsome prince to wake her up.
Well, there is a kiss, and it doesn't work.
But it doesn't work.
That's a spoiler. We've spoiled it for people. But
I think people maybe kind of half of, they might know the ending of Sleeping Beauty anyway. And I guess that's the thing about something like fairy tale, that it can change with both the cultural period that it's been told in and the medium which has been used to tell it.
I mean, the humanities which we, you know, were talking about in terms of keeping the memory, keeping the record of the past, reopening the record of the past, revisioning the past. But the humanities are also the place of exploring what the possibilities are, of actually throwing open a door onto alternatives. And I'd say that some of the ways that fairy tales have been reworked, I mean, I don't know if you saw The Shape of Water, Guillermo del Toro. Well, that was a Beauty and the Beast story. But again, it had a kind of environmental feeling. It had a bit of Cold War, sort of surveillance, horror, social oppression. And it kind of reimagined a different world, a world of harmony and love between a mute girl and this sort of sea monster.
And that worked for you at that level, did it? Did it work as a reimagining or a retelling of the story?
Well, I think he's an extraordinary filmmaker, and he's steeped in this material. And maybe he'll do an Irish fairy tale. That would be really good. The folklore and fairy lore of the world lies open still for reimagining. And actually, in this document by Imagination We Live, they stress the potential of sort of digital techniques of AI and also the danger. So that's an area, a sort of polemical area, that people working with writing and expression can, you know, engage with that. You know, one of my favourite stories about the effects of fairy tale is The Lord of the Rings, which was made as a film. Well, first of all, The Lord of the Rings was written by an Anglo-Saxon scholar, a most obscure subject, which nobody really wants to study. So there he was, and he wrote this amazing world-class bestseller. Then it was made into a film, and the GNP of New Zealand was entirely transformed because they developed CGI in New Zealand to create Gollum and all the other, and it was an early pioneer of CGI. And as a result, it became the world's centre for CGI animation. I don't know if it still is, but literally the GDP of that country was absolutely transfigured by an imaginary world created by a sort of someone who'd suffered the First World War and reimagined apocalypse from his little study in pipe smoking in Oxford.
Yeah, and creates this Middle Earth world for us. But, you know, in some ways it could be a Greek myth, it could be a Norse myth, it could be a Celtic myth. In many ways, it's just slightly different words to very similar tunes.
Exactly.
I do want to come back to Frozen, though.
Yes, Frozen. Yes.
We've had that you think the Maleficent retelling is a good retelling. Mm. Frozen, you're not quite so sure whether it gets the retelling of the Snow Queen quite right.
Well, I think that the story is rather wonderful. The friendship between the children, the two sisters. And I actually thought the whole idea of being frozen was an allegory of our age. I mean, and of the worst effects of sort of social media, of Facebook, that you get sort of frozen into an image, or frozen into your past life, which you sort of can't get rid of. So I thought there was something there, and I was very struck how many little girls would be in the street singing, "Let it go, let it go, let it go," and twirling as they did. So it really gave them something. They really identified with this possibility of letting the world melt and dissolve and become a sort of a different place. That magic of loosening something. So I liked that of it. I think it was very, I don't like the way it's drawn at all. I don't like those wasp-waisted, saucer-eyed, sort of unreal girls, not at all.
So is that, was it the visual aspect more than anything else?
That I think the whole of the Disney aesthetic is not very successful. I mean, I know it's successful in the world, but compared to some of the other animations or the ways that, the way that Guillermo del Toro thinks of a girl is a very different entity, a very incarnated person. She's a real person. Some of his heroines are real people. I know he's using live, but he also uses CGI. But he doesn't produce this sort of anorexic, vain types of bodies.
Can I ask you briefly about Alone of All Her Sex, the myth and cult of the Virgin Mary, a book that you published back in the 1970s and quite very controversial at the time, it has to be said. You have a memory of an interview in these very studios with two priests present?
Yes, and I was definitely persona non grata. And I was quite young at the time, and they were quite a bit older than me, pointed their fingers at me and called me a dreadful sinner, which is, of course, what I was quite used to as a child anyway. But
what were you saying about the Virgin Mary, or about the cult of the Virgin Mary, really, that was causing them such bother?
Well, I tried to put it in a historical context, and that was controversial. I didn't treat the doctrines of the Virgin Mary as revealed truths. I treated them as historically created ideas at different points in time. It was a book very much of its period, of a feminist book of the 70s, in which I showed the interactions between the image of the Virgin and the prescribed image for womanhood, and the excessive emphasis on chastity, on both the sexual danger of the woman, the Eve idea, and then the extreme virtue of not being a sexual being, which is, of course, how Mary was presented to me as a young woman. The book was written before I had a child, and I would have actually written more about motherhood and the image of Mary as a mother if I hadn't at the time been a young woman who hadn't yet had a child.
Marina Warner there, when she was speaking to me when she was in Dublin to launch the Irish Humanities Alliance strategic plan. That plan was in a document called By Imagination We Live. And you can find out more information on irishhumanities.com. In the late 1970s, a young street artist who began his artistic life painting graffiti in the city's walls sold his first painting to another emerging New York artist. That artist was the Blondie singer Deborah Harry. Over the course of the next few years, that street artist, Jean-Michel Basquiat, stunned the New York American art scenes with his radical and untamed expressionist paintings. But by the late 1980s, his involvement with drugs took its toll. He died of an overdose in 1988 at the age of just 27. Although acclaimed across the art world and filmed various occasions talking about his art, only one photographer, Roland Hagenberg, was able to capture Basquiat at work in his New York studio. Roland is with me in this studio right now ahead of his upcoming Dublin exhibition, which features some of the photographs of Basquiat that Roland took. How would you describe, Roland, first of all, Jean-Michel Basquiat and the impact that he had on American art in the 1980s?
I don't know if he had so much impact in the 80s, but I think the most important feature is that he is the first African-American artist who was accepted in the contemporary art world, which was dominated by white male curators, museum directors, collectors. So I think, like all the other artists, compared to the other artists, that separates him, and that was his most strongest impact.
What was that scene like? I mean, maybe the impact came later on, perhaps, but what was that 1980s scene in New York like? Because you arrived there as a relatively young man into the midst of the mayhem and madness that was 1980s New York.
Yeah, I was at that time writing for German magazine Stern. It was a weekly magazine, and the first report was actually about a friend of Basquiat. They were all kids, like I was too, spraying in the subway, doing graffiti, and there were hundreds or thousands of them, and who knows who will really become the rich guy. I mean, Basquiat painting today is 120 million, one piece. No? So we were all dreaming of becoming famous, which the idol was Andy Warhol. You arrived there with just a suitcase in New York and try to make it somehow. But I was there writing a report on a friend of Basquiat, Michael Stewart, who was actually strangled by the police in the subway in New York while spraying the walls. And that story came out big in Germany and then came to New York and uncovered actually the police brutality in New York. So that was the beginning of that.
Did you see anything in them, apart from the fact that you were possibly hoping at that time that you would become famous and make a lot of money, but did you see anything in Basquiat's art, in his street art, that made him stand out from those others who were in the subways trying to do the same thing?
I would not see. I doubted if other people saw it too, but what you could see was his attitude, his character. He was very self-assured, and he knew already at that time, in a time where there was no Facebook or something, how to present himself and how to... He was a very charming guy. He had, of course, many girlfriends, and he attracted people, and he knew how to put himself in the middle of the scene in a very modest way, and that made him appealing. So it was not so much the art that was important, but the personality.
And I guess that's what, because among the, as I mentioned in the exhibition that's coming up in Dublin, there are a number of photographs that you took of him. Were you, as far as you know, you were the only photographer to get into his studio and to take that type of photograph of him in mid-flight, as it were?
Yes, it was on Crosby Street, that particular studio, and it's a play of history that no photos survived from that time while he was painting in that studio. And it's always, looking back in history, interesting how images make then afterwards an artist. We know that famous image of Picasso in the striped T-shirt. We know, when we think of Franz Kafka, of that black and white image, or Sigmund Freud.
Yeah.
Those are not images which someone had decided they will make the artist, but it's kind of...
Subsequently.
Subsequently. And I think one or two of those images became or will become the definite image of Basquiat, the tortured artist in the dark Soho studio, stricken by poverty, but still with one foot becoming a millionaire.
Yeah, but to what extent do you think that was? You know, did he know how to strike that pose, as it were? Because, you know, there is a real look of melancholy on his face. Was that inherent? Is that energy within him, or was it something that he could produce, if you like, for the camera?
No, I think these photos he didn't produce. All the other photos, there are of course other photos of Basquiat too, but I always say they are more like the party shots, or especially then afterwards when he appeared on the cover of Time magazine, it was all posing, and that was also under the influence of Andy Warhol, to present yourself, to pose. But those photographs are actually... Actually, all my photographs are taken after I interviewed the artist. So you build already up
a rapport.
A rapport with, and it becomes more natural, and there is no posing in that sense. Also, we were in the discussion fighting actually about European art and American art, and at one point he wanted to throw me out of the studio.
Was he dismissing European art?
Pardon?
Was he dismissing European art?
Yeah, well, I said... in Berlin, we have the ideas, and in New York is the money. So that's why all the artists go to New York, and he was very upset about that.
Yeah, well, what would he make then, as you said, 120 million? What was the Sotheby's price? $110 million, $120 million, somewhere in that region. What would he make of that, since he was so upset about your idea that New York could monetize art? What do you think he would make of that type of value being put on his work? Monetary value.
Actually, that's what all the artists hope for. that they will become the next Warhol. And that was the whole motivation. And you cannot forget, it was at the same time a very dangerous time. There was mugging, there was AIDS. There, so many artists didn't survive that dream they carried with them.
The other photograph in this book that you brought in to me, which is a collection of photographs not just of Basquiat but of others there as well, but there was it struck me, we see him in the studio actually painting with some piece of, it looks like perhaps a canvas, perhaps just material stretched over a wooden frame. It's down on the ground. There's quite an energy in that. Did the energy change when he started to paint? Did you see a different side of the artist when he was actually making art?
Well, he was, I think that happens to any artist who is visited by a journalist. And I came there, first of all, as a journalist and second of all, as a photographer. But you enter a sphere and you destroy it with your appearance. And at that moment when he started to paint, of course, it releases, he's more himself. He doesn't have to pretend or think about words. He was not very articulate, I must say. And
I guess that's why he painted.
That's, you could say, as a painter, you don't have to explain, which I don't think so.
Finally then, just the exhibition that will be shown in Dublin, there are some of your own photographs there, but also there are, is it re-realizations of some of Basquiat's work or reimaginings of Basquiat's work?
Yeah, I show the original prints, and I have also a collaboration work with Joe Henry, a Scottish painter. And I thought it quite interesting to have a contemporary artist express the mood of that era. Joe didn't live in New York at that time, but I did. So I look forward to do that.
Right. So we have your photographs, original prints, and then Joe Henry's
collaboration, a kind of reaction
to them, or feeding off the works of Basquiat. Well, that exhibition, and hardly surprisingly then, has all three names in it. The title, Jean-Michel Basquiat, Roland Hagenberg, and Joe Henry. Yeah. It will launch in Dublin on November the 13th this year at the Sal Fine Art. And you can find out full details on the website, which is salstudio.ie.
And we are also at the RDS Art Source at booth 111. I will be there. So,
all right, booth 111 at the RDS Art Source as well. That is Roland Hagenberg speaking to me on this Tuesday evening. Ten minutes to eight on Tuesday night's Arena. She has been lauded as a visionary for breaking the rules of stand-up comedy in her daring one-woman show, Nanette. Viewed by millions on Netflix, the Australian comedian Hannah Gadsby comes to Ireland this week with her follow-up show, which is called Douglas. Hannah Gadsby has been speaking to RTÉ's AB Philbin Bowman, and AB's with me in studio now. Tell us about Hannah Gadsby, first of all, if you would, AB. And what was happening before Nanette, which has been such a massive hit on Netflix?
So she's an Australian comedian. She's from Tasmania, which is the island off the south of Australia. It's part of Australia, but it's geographically separate. That's where she grew up. And she describes it actually at one point in her show as being an island which is famous for potatoes, a small gene pool, and where homosexuality was illegal until the 1990s. So if you're Irish, you're going, we can relate to a fair bit of that, to be fair. But she started as comedy in 2006. She'd kind of done a different odd job. She did an art history degree, fell into stand-up, and it just really started going really well for her. She's getting on television. But then, this was just a sort of a seismic leap. What was interesting, though, about her pre-Nanette career is she got to a point where you go on television, and it's an interesting leap for comics, because instead of doing your own shows for your audience who like you or are paying money to see you, once you go on television, you're in people's living rooms and they don't all like you. And if, as Hannah Gadsby sort of alludes to, the fact that she is mistaken for being a man sometimes, and you go on television like that, you get pretty negative reactions. This is a clip of her from about 5 years ago, 2014, and she's talking about the kind of reaction she gets on television. She's on TV doing comedy about the reaction, and this is one of the messages she got from a rather aggressive male viewer.
But he called me a fat, ugly bitch. That, according to Mr. Man, are my weaknesses. I'm a fat, ugly bitch. Now, I'll give him fat. I'm a bit heavy, right? It's just there. I think my body's hanging on to the hope that I'll get pregnant in the desert, and will all survive. I'll give him that, I'm fat. But I'm not giving him a bitch. I'm not a bitch. I don't have the strength of character for that. I'm too lazy. It's like, oh, are we still talking about her? It's just, I'll have a nap.
And that's Hannah Gadsby from her show Nanette, which is currently available on Netflix. Hannah Gadsby coming to Dublin this weekend, isn't it?
Yes, it's a Sunday. That's from her about 5 years ago. Mm. And what's interesting, the reason I picked that clip out, and apologies for the language, the original is actually a lot stronger in terms of language, is that it shows you the way she was tackling the homophobia. She was creating tension by mentioning it and then going, but it's not that serious. I actually am fat. I can laugh at it. I can defuse it. But in order to do that, she was kind of putting herself down. And that's very much at the harsh of, she just found herself in that cycle of constantly making jokes about this and then sort of taking away the tension and then at some point going, you know, I'm not comfortable doing this anymore. And that's kind of the genesis of Nanette. Really.
Yeah, because Nanette in some ways, I was saying this to you beforehand, Nanette, what it manages to do is you're laughing and saying, yeah, she's making some serious points here, but she can do the two things at the same time almost. Yeah.
Absolutely. It starts off, you're watching it, it feels like a very conventional comedy show. Here she is talking about being a lesbian and not always being totally comfortable within the sort of, you know, gay pride, LGBT community. Here's her take on that.
My favourite sound in the whole world is the sound of a teacup finding its place on a saucer. Oh, it's very, very difficult to flaunt that lifestyle in a parade. I don't even like the flag. Controversial. There, I've said it. Now, the pride flag. Now, I love what it means. That is perfect. Pride, wonderful. But the flag itself, a bit busy. It's just six very shouty, assertive colours stacked on top of each other. No rest for the eye. An afternoon of that waving in my face, I need to express my identity through the metaphor of a nap.
Hannah Gadsby there, and that is from the show Nanette, that particular clip, although there are times in that show when she seems to cover some of the material, maybe, I suppose, that she had been using earlier on that comes back. But we were saying, Abby, that one of the things that she does is this hilariously funny stand-up routine. But then she almost turns it on his head. I said, this is a bit like a TED Talk with jokes. Now, it's more than that, but there's an aspect of TED Talk in it.
I think the thing you have to remember, Sean, is like comedians have done this for a long time. I mean, Bill Hicks is kind of lauded as, and you know, hero, made this absolute hero as like this comedy god who spoke truth to power. And for every Bill Hicks, there are 1,000 comedians who want to be that, try it, and it just falls totally flat. To actually talk straight with, I mean, it is hard enough to make a room full of people laugh, but to hold their attention completely without having a laugh to go to is actually much harder. I speak of having tried to do this myself and failed many times. She manages to do that. She goes from comedy into some pretty serious territory. Here she is talking about what it was like growing up in Tasmania for her.
From the years 1989 to 1997, right, this is 10 years, effectively my adolescence. Tasmania was at the centre of a very toxic national debate about homosexuality and whether or not it should be legalised. And I'm from the northwest coast of Tasmania, the Bible Belt. 70% of the people I lived amongst believe that homosexuality should be a criminal act. 70% of the people who raised me, who loved me, who I trusted, believed that homosexuality was a sin, that homosexuals were heinous, subhuman pedophiles. 70%! And by the time I identified as being gay, it was too late. I was already homophobic. And you do not get to just flick a switch on that. No, what you do is you internalise that homophobia and you learn to hate yourself.
And that's Hannah Gadsby, I suppose, in a more serious mode within her show, Nanette.
Absolutely. And what's amazing is the way she segues from one to the other. And I think, you know, it's almost unfair to take out random clips and go, here's a bit of this, here's a bit of this. You know, it is of a piece and it kind of builds from the humour. She builds up the rapport with the audience and she earns herself the licence to go off on that really powerful section.
Yeah, because it's not just, she gives us 45 minutes of comedy and then she gives us 3 minutes of serious message end. This is 54 minutes and I would guess you could, it's, I don't know if it's 50-50, but there's a fairly even division between I'm making a serious point here and here's a joke just to keep, as she talks about the sugar to make the medicine go down.
But the thing is, like, comedians have done this for ages. This is a really...
And why is she so different then?
What's interesting is, right, one of the most interesting facts about this show is that if you look at Rotten Tomatoes, the review aggregating website, the critics, 46 of them, give it an average rating of 100%. It is exceptional. And yet the public one is 22%. And my very strong suspicion, Sean, is this show is triggering for a certain kind of entitled, angry guy who feels that women's movements shouldn't happen and has given it negative ratings deliberately to try and drag down the average. She has a go at straight white men, which I think is worth listening to.
I wouldn't want to be a straight white man. Not if you paid me. Although the pay would be substantially better. No, I don't think it's an easy time. Easy time for you fellas. I do feel for you. Very difficult, very confusing time. Because you're not coping. Because for the first time ever, you're suddenly a subcategory of human. Right? You're like, no, we invented the categories. We're not supposed to play. We're human neutral. Not anymore. I've always been judged by what I am. Always been a fat, ugly dyke, and I'm dead inside. I can cope. But you fellas, it's something to believe. You're like, nah, you hear straight white man, and you're like, nah, that's reverse sexism. No, it's not. You wrote the rules, read them.
Nanette Gadsby there from her show, Nanette. So, Abby Philbin Bowman, just to round up then, she's coming with a show called Douglas to the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre next Sunday. What can we expect there?
Well, I think she won't be doing the self-deprecating style of humour, but she said she did want to go back to comedy because when the whole world is watching you after a huge success like this, firstly, she said, I had to accept that I live in the shadow of it. And secondly, I have to have the right to fail. Trying to learn an entirely new skill, like if she's going to acting or make a film, she's like, I don't know how to do those things. Doing all that when the world is watching you is a bit too brave. So she's going to go for a comedy, but I imagine there'll be some serious content as well. It works so well in the show, why not do that?
Absolutely.
So and it will be eventually on Netflix, but if you want to see it live, it's this Sunday.
Abby Philbin Bowman talking to us there about Hannah Gadsby. Her new show is called Douglas. You can get to it this Sunday at the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre, bordgáisenergytheatre.ie. We'll give you all of the details. That's our lot for this evening. Liam Murphy researched. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Harry Brook was on sound, and tonight's programme was produced by Olin McGann. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7. John Creedon is on the way.